Past week we've been at this ordination ceremony at the City of 10,000 Buddhas, and very Mahayana Buddhism is incredibly inspiring. And very Chinese, very a lot of almost continuous rituals. The thing that they came away with was just the amount of dedication, total commitment to the holy life that the disciples of Master Hua have. It's really impressive. You don't see such in California, where everything's so diluted with conceptual proliferations and ideas, that you see people really just getting in and practicing, you know, just letting go of things and doing what has to be done, and not getting caught up in the endless proliferations of their minds. One can see even the point of all their rituals was that to do them, you just had to let go of all your what you wanted to do, and what, you know, like if you wanted time for yourself or space, I need space, I need more time alone, I can't work so hard, and I can't get up in the morning, and all the excuses and selfish self-involvements just don't apply there. It's a total kind of surrender. And being very Chinese, then it's also, you have to learn another language. You have to sit through long talks in Chinese and then the translations. Or the ones in English then are translated into Chinese. So this gives you a chance to develop patient endurance. The thing, now really important to say in this life, what I've been trying to get across here to all of you is just the one-pointedness to not make problems about the form and tradition and all this, but to just get on with the practice of purifying the mind, letting go of, and realizing the true nature of things. Because if you can't really do that, if you really want something else other than enlightenment, then this isn't the proper place for you to be. Because I don't want anyone here as a monk or a nun whose sole aim is not to be enlightened, who really wants maybe some kind of position, or wants some kind of worldly status, or wants things to be other than what they are on the conventional plane. If you still believe that things should be something, some other way, and you can't see that in your mind, you can't really observe it and let go, then maybe you should go somewhere else where you can find a convention or maybe you can create your own convention. Nothing to stop you from creating your own conventions. But here, it's a tradition and a lineage that is to be surrendered, we relinquish all our selfish, even our ideals, to abide within the restraint the form of this tradition. And then you can reflect on the way things are, the arising and ceasing of the conditioned realm, and the realization of the true Dhamma. And that's very much what one feels is what Master Hua is doing in California. It's very much the whole purpose is toward a true realization rather than towards accommodating all the opinions and views and ideas of modern America. I mean, I personally find it tiresome to hear the endless minds that just go on about things in the world, because on the worldly plane, it's going to even get worse probably. There's so many changes going on now, and so much confusion probably for the next 2 decades on the worldly plane, politically, economically, socially, in every way. Everything is terribly confused, and people will be caught up in that confusion. So if you don't have any clarity yourself, you're just going to find yourself even more confused by all the hopes, desires, ideals that you might have for happiness and justice and fairness in the world. The importance of silence and restraint. And in America, this Tibetan Vajra regent that has AIDS, and all the conceptual proliferations that Americans produce around that. This is a controversy of great proportions, because the Americans seem to be very much one way of everything's all right and do what you want, and at the next moment becoming very puritanical and becoming very judgmental and wanting to punish somebody for being immoral or not being honest, but yet having previously given everybody the right to be immoral and dishonest. No, it's a very I can see this in myself. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm without it, because I can be quite idealistic and wanting the large ideas of freedom and justice, and the next moment become quite judgmental of myself or others. But the thing that's missing in all that, in that group that comes from Boulder, Colorado, and Chogyam Trungpa, is that they've never established a moral restraint to work from. It's the idea of the crazy wisdom, where they exalt this idea of crazy wisdom, where it somehow gives you the idea that moral restraint is almost immoral, or that it's crazy, and that crazy wisdom is sanity. And crazy wisdom, I guess, amounts to being able to do what you want to do totally, or follow every impulse, and it's called enlightenment. I don't know, but it's very confused, because nobody really has any standards, any real wisdom to work from. Their minds aren't mirrors for reflection. They just have a lot of ideas. A lot of the ideas are very good ideas, admittedly, but they're not coming from wisdom. They're coming from grasping of good ideas. Another way to get a mind that's a mirror and clear and bright is through, say, very, very powerful moral commitments. You can't use your body and speech foolishly and expect to have any real clarity. You have to determine to have to really establish a powerful moral commitment. Restraint, say in the Vinaya discipline that we follow, it's a very powerful commitment to a high level of moral restraint. Now it isn't because of puritanical reasons. It's not because of hating the body or making judgments against sex or freedom or whatever, but it's a convention in order that one can actually realize and have a pure heart and a reflective mind, a mirror-like mind, crystal clear, bright and intelligent, which you'll never realize that in the world of idealism, because idealism is something you grasp, not something that comes from the clarity of understanding Dhamma. So you find so many, the endless gobbledygook cycle babble of California is just conceptual proliferation at its most nauseating. Because every time I go there, I come back feeling slightly sick at my stomach from hearing the endless justifications and conceptual proliferations of the people involved in Buddhism there. And and none of it comes from a real clarity of, or having a realization, but all kinds of opinions, views, ideas. One does detect with Master Xuanhua a real clarity and a one-pointedness that is really moving. That's why it's very powerful, because the pure heart, the pure mind is where it's a powerful thing. It's not a weak. It doesn't seem like much when you're practicing, does it? Because your passions and your emotions might seem really powerful, and the clarity of the mind doesn't when you're thinking about it or trying to find it. Where your anger and resentments and bitterness and greed, all that have a sense of power, but it's an importance. But all that really just falls away. It's impermanent. It's unsubstantial, and it just ends up confusing us when we're caught in just the emotional range of our minds and the attachments and views and opinions that we believe in and that we don't witness to as Dhamma. As far as monastic life goes, here in England, I really feel even more important that you develop this way rather than it was spreading Buddhism or all the kind of idealistic things that we can become, that can seem very urgent and important that the world impinges on a monastery like this with all its ideas and views and demands and urgent requirements. And if you can't realize the true nature of things, then you are wasting your life. If you're just if you're just here for anything but the but that, for anything less than enlightenment, then you're probably wasting your life, because you're not going to be enlightened if you don't really determine to be so. Just like with the nuns now, it really, I don't want to hear any more complaints or grumbling from the nuns about the position of women. If you complain to me or Ajahn Sajito any more about your position, you can go and go somewhere else. Because that means you aren't practicing. And you don't really want to be here. You don't really want to be it. Maybe you want to be enlightened in your own, when you have everything that you want. But that means you don't really see the point of enlightenment. You don't, that's not what your is important to you. It's to establish yourself as a woman or a nun with equality and freedom and the same thing that the bhikkhus have, and all these ideas. And those are worldly things, those are worldly ideas. And that's not the holy life. The way to develop the pure heart is to be grateful, see? Be grateful for the four requisites. For the robes you have, the alms food, the shelter, the medicine that's given, the teaching that's offered, the moral impeccability that's required of you. Those are the things to develop gratitude, a sense of joy and gratitude for that, rather than complaining about the form of this tradition. And on this, I'm not going to budge an inch. Not one quarter of an inch, or the smallest measurement, because it would be doing an injustice to you if I, at any time, gave the impression that you didn't have what was necessary for enlightenment. You have it all. Nuns have everything that they need, the teaching, the moral base, the requisites. It's all perfectly equal with the monks. There's nothing that the monks have, as far as what's necessary for enlightenment, that the nuns don't have. You start contemplating like this, and then you have to really contemplate also what your mind does, how it grumbles and complains, and it will. And if you can't ever see the grumbling and complaining of it as anicca dukkha anatta, if you believe in it, then you get pulled into that world of being somebody, being a woman who feels she's doesn't have equal rights with men, and all this, and the whole conceptual proliferation starts going around. The holy life is almost the exact opposite of the worldly life. In the worldly life, you want equal rights, and you don't want to be, everything's got to be, say, democratic, and you've got to feel that you're respected and your voice is heard, and all these kind of ideas are very much for the worldly community. But for the holy life, it's being content with what is offered, and practicing the Dhamma. those of you who are content, who are grateful for the alms food that put into your bowl. That's a pure heart then, that's purity of the mind, that sense of reflecting and saying, this is offered to me by the devoted lay community. You're not analyzing the quality of the food. Not going into whether it has all the necessary vitamins or amounts of protein, carbohydrates, and that. But say the pure heart isn't. If you establish yourself with a reflection of alms food, then you can see the grumbling mind, the obsessions you have about diet, and what you think is necessary and all that for food. With the moral restraint, you have the Sila Dharas have the 10 precepts, and then all the other training rules. So this is to see that you're the high level of moral integrity that is offered to you to live a completely you're morally protected. There's no way that you can be exploited on the moral plane, you know, through immorality. Your duty is to live within that restraint and to uphold the level of moral integrity. This is if you can't do this, then that's fair enough. There's plenty of other opportunities for compromising and doing all kinds of things. There's modern Buddhist movements and all kinds of opportunities where they might suit what your ideals a little more than this life, than this particular form. But really contemplate. What the worldly life is where you can get pretty much what you want and you're respected as an individual and you are appreciated and there's equality and freedom. So I can appreciate the desire for that. But if we dilute the goal and say make these worldly things more important than the goal, then of course the whole thing loses its power and it is of no value anymore. Just trying to hang on to a tradition or to a position as a monk or a nun or being a meditation teacher or all these things are worldly goals. What are you here for? To become a meditation teacher or an authority on Buddhism or to establish a bhikkhuni order or to spread the Dhamma or to create women's spirituality or do this or do that. That's the worldly aim. Those might be very good, some of them very good aims, very good goals, but they are only of worldly quality. And if you attach to them, then you end up with grief, sorrow, despair, and anguish. Where when you're basing your life on gratitude for having a robe to wear today and alms food in your bowl, medicine for illness, a shelter for the night, the teaching of the Dhamma, and the ability to live under moral restraint, when you reflect from that, you're not saying how free you are, whether you're respected or as a person, or whether your people understand you, or all these kind of personality conditions can be seen as that which arises is subject to, is what subject to arising is subject to ceasing. Now the Sila Dharas, you've been in this long enough to stop it, to stop complaining, and stop the conceptual proliferation, believing in the foolishness of your mind. Because if you don't stop it, then you're just creating the karma to be born again in the same kind of confusion. You just got to stop believing all the foolishness of your that goes on in your mind, and trust in the and realize more the true clarity and nature of things, the pure heart. And in the City of 10,000 Buddhas, that's very much the attitude. It's a pretty powerful place because the total commitment to realizations there. Where the rest of what I see in California in the Vipassana movement is really all over the place. It's just so endlessly kind of convoluted and idealistic and confused. And these might be hard words, but this is to me the only thing worth. This to me is all I'm a monk for. I'm not a monk to be an abbot or a teacher of meditation or anything other. I'm the same as you. I'm here only for that one-pointed realization. I don't care about my position or being anyone or having any role. If any kind of concern comes up in my mind about myself, whether people respect me or people give me a lot of praise or people criticize or whatever, this is just for Dhamma reflection. I'm willing to work within the position I'm in, but only for the realization of Dhamma, not for any other. Any other reason is seen as for what it is, as what is subject to arising, subject to ceasing. With a lineage, our loyalty is with modern Buddhist movements. You don't have lineages, so you have maybe, even though they call them traditions and. Everything gets called a tradition these days. If it's been going on for 2 weeks, it's a tradition. But a lineage and a tradition is in Theravada is to the original, to the Gautama, the Buddha. And the establishment of the Vinaya discipline as he established it, it has its point to make. The dependency, I say, of the bhikkhuni sangha on the bhikkhu sangha has some validity in as dhamma. It's not just male chauvinism, as modern women like to think. It has a natural dhamma relationship. It's based on the natural way of things. The whole Vinaya discipline is to realize the natural law. It's not that Buddha was a male chauvinist. And so you if you are willing to follow the tradition, then you begin to awaken to the true nature of Dhamma and the natural law, the natural way of things, rather than with the idealism of the time where nature is idealized but never really felt or understood. isn't it? Now we have the Green Party and the ecology movement and all of this conservation, and it's very much an idealization of nature. Now we're tired of polluting it, and we're back to idealizing it. But how many of you really understand it in your own, through your own, say, reflection and contemplation? Because these are all conditions in nature: male, female, human bodies, the animal kingdom, the sun and moon and stars, and the whole cosmos is nature or Dhamma. And everything is related and dependent. So it's very complicated on the conditioned realm. We have to learn from the particular karmic position we're in, as being a male or a female, with the kind of situations that we find ourselves in, the places we're living in, and the way things are. Just the aging, the process of the human form, and its pain, sicknesses, death. Just the emotional level of our minds, the feeling, the love, the anger, the passions of our heart. Are natural. But if you identify with nature as a self, then of course you throw yourself outside the natural harmony, because the selfish view based on me as a person, as a separate human being, that identity of me as a separate human being gives a distortion to the natural flow and meaning of life. And so if you attach to being a man or a woman, just that will throw you out of understanding and being in that flow, the natural flow of things. That's a part of the natural flow, but it's not a self. It's not what you are or your true identity. And if you, for one moment, attach to anything, then you tend to create a whole artifice of delusion. And then that artifice is based on nothing sound or real, but on feelings and ideas, and they collapse. So you end up with sokha pariteva tukha tomanasa upayasa, grief, sorrow, despair, and anguish. For the monks, they don't tend to. Monks tend to look at their grumbling minds. They can see that. Where women tend to believe it. You don't hear the bhikkhus grumbling, or if they do, then you can always point it out, and they tend to get the point. But the nuns do grumble a lot, and they do believe their grumbling minds, and it really, if you can't stop it, and you've got to just stop it, not go around thinking you've got to go dump it on Ajahn Sujito, let him know what you think. This is a horrible thing to do. If you're really neurotic and you can't stop it, then maybe ask for apologize and say, Ajahn Sujito, can I dump this shit onto you? And then if he says, please be my guest. But the Buddha did say that women can be enlightened. So we beyond the obvious doubts in my mind, I assume that that is possible. Because if you can't, I've said this often enough, and if you aren't willing to do it, then please go. Because I don't, it's a waste of time, and there's no point of you being here if you aren't willing to practice. And to practice means to do it now, not to put it off till next year or the next retreat. And I think, you know, I think I've offered all that I can as an individual monk. I can't do more than this for you. I can't fulfill all your wishes or make life what you want it to be. This is all I can do. And if you don't find this what you want or it's not enough, then maybe you'll find something else that. Somebody else that'll give you what you want, but I do have no, I have no doubt in my mind that this is enough. This is what is necessary and absolutely essential for enlightenment. There's nothing lacking here. There's nothing missing. There's both for the men and the women, the monks and the nuns. It's equal opportunity. I don't see where the nuns are not in any lesser position for enlightenment. They have the same teaching, alms mendicancy, moral foundation. Then if you want something more than that, you can see that as a desire. Desire for something more. If you're willing to pursue that, to be determined, to have a real resolve and one-pointed determination to crack it, then you will be enlightened. I guarantee it. But if you can't use the, if you don't understand what I'm saying right now, well then, probably you're not really meant to be a Buddhist. Or if you want to hear something else, whatever you can, you know, this has to come from your effort and a real strong determination. It's not half-heartedness. Here, there's no room for half-heartedness. Now this is from just going to the City of 10,000 Buddhas that inspired this talk this morning. because I'm really glad to see that kind of commitment. You know, it's a hard place, and yet, to live there is certainly not an easy one. But it's the commitment and the one-pointedness that the Master Hua is so keen on, and what he's so compassionate in providing, that one-pointed, uninterrupted determination. And this is very much, say, from my experience in Thailand with Ajahn Chah, and that really wise masters can do this. They don't water down something to where it becomes all fuzzy and caught up in things that are going to distract you from the true goal. Like the idea of the holy fool, isn't it, where the bishop is in the beautiful palace, the archbishop in the beautiful palace with all the servants and comforts and the high position, and then the monk or the nun in the rags kind of looking a bit stupid, being the holy fool, grateful for the crust of bread that the servants of the archbishop offer, or whatever. This is the kind of one, grateful for what is offered, rather than saying, if the archbishop has all this, I want to have it too. Or he could afford more than a crust of bread, the miser, stingy so-and-so. He could give me an organically pure, whole-grained, vegetarian diet, and I should have the best kind of medical treatment, and I should have the best robes, and all of this is what the desire mind. But the holy fool is one that's grateful for a crust of bread or the piece of cloth to patch the robe, a chance to hear the Dhamma, the respect for the moral commitment. And you think, well, the monks get more respect than the nuns. Monks get more respect than the nuns. It's not fair. And we monks have to go and bow to the nuns, have to bow to the monks. And it's not fair. And it's not right, and something in me doesn't like it, and I don't really want to do this. And we've got to understand the true nature of women's spirituality, and we've got to have this and that, and then the whole thing is one of you're like the bishop, and you're trying to find a place in the hierarchy, have a position of power or equality in the hierarchy. But it doesn't matter whether you're equal or above or below if the attitude is right. And that's to be grateful for the alms food, for the robe, for the shelter, for the medicine provided, for a chance to encouragement to practice, hear the Dhamma, and to the encouragement and respect for the moral precept. Now keep that in your mind. It's very simple, isn't it? The moral precepts, the material standard is the four requisites. The meditation is on all that is subject to arising is subject to ceasing. The goal or the realization or the enlightenment is to realize and through insight the cessation of that which ceases and the true purity, the immortal purity the true intelligence and immortal purity, the true nature of things, the true nature of Dhamma. And for that, you don't need to be the archbishop in the palace, or to be a bhikkhu, or to be senior bhikkhu, or to be have any position, or there's not one here that has, just because one is senior, doesn't mean that one is any more, has any more benefits to the holy life. That's nothing to do with the holy life. It's just conventions of that allow harmony of the Sangha. If you're really a Sangha member, then you no longer make problems about the structure and the convention and the hierarchy of it, but you've already accepted it and no longer identified with the structure. The structure is what it is. And you understand it, you know it, and you abide within its limits. But it's not a self-identity anymore. It's not a position that you're attached to. And when it's not self and it's not a position to be attached to, then that's true Sangha, rather than men and women, individuals, personalities that can go all over the place, and nationalities, and the educated, uneducated, all the differences that exist between the individuals in this Sangha. In fact, the nun's order, if it's going to be of any use or any value to you or to other women, you have to support that structure. You have to determine, no matter what the pressures are on you from outside, to be grateful, to learn how to reflect on that limitation, to accept that limitation. And I can't ask you to be grateful, but I can say definitely that the more you appreciate what you have, then you will experience true gratitude. Because I know you're under a lot of pressure from the modern women who feel it isn't right and you're not being treated fairly. But that's how it might look to worldly people, because they don't value the moral restraint or the four requisites or the chance to practice or hear the Dhamma. They think all that is something not so important as having equal positions and have all the ideas that fit in with modern democratic egalitarian idealism. How many of you will be enlightened through this? Don't know. It's up to you, isn't it? I can't, much as I would like to wave a magic wand over you and enlighten you, it'd be a lot easier if I could do it for you. And I've no, you know, I certainly would do it if it were possible. But inevitably, it comes down to you, doesn't it, to how wise and determined you are to use wisdom, to be wise. It's not a matter of becoming wise, but being wise right now. And that purity of the heart is not mine. It's not male or female. So being wise is immediate. It's seeing the way it is. It's not become. You'll never become a wise person. Just more and more, you use wisdom. You be wise in daily life, here and now. So as monks, as nuns, the practice is be wise, rather than trying to become a wise person later on. And how to be wise is by, say, the Dhamma teachings are the reflections of a Buddha, teachings of the Buddha, in order to realize true wisdom. And it's very simple, isn't it? All that is subject to rising, subject to ceasing. Very simple. The conditioned arises and ceases in the unconditioned. The two most clear presentations of wisdom on the conventional plane of language. And then the real insight has to come through your continuous application of energy to a continuous understanding and true realization of those Four Noble Truths. Mm-hmm.